Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Bald Move Prestige. This is the podcast where we talk about only the most serious, well-respected, hallowed films. Today, we're going to be talking about 1993's Basic Instinct, which I apologize for because I was under the mistaken impression that this was actually taken seriously by people back in the day. I was in high school and everyone was talking about this movie and how shocking it is and how controversial it was. And it looked, you know, every time I saw this and the commercials for it and seen it discussed, it always looked slick and well made and very adult. So I thought that meant it was a good movie. I've not seen it. I've not ever seen the film until just the last 24 hours. And I'm here to tell you, it's not really a serious film. I should have known it, directed by Paul Verhoeven. He of RoboCop, of Total Recall, of Showgirls, of Starship Troopers, of Hollow Man, that this would be a deeply subversive and a parody? No, not a parody, a satire, deeply satirical film. And just the Americans of the 90s could not possibly get it.
It definitely wants to be serious. Like the satire you're taking out of it, I'm pretty sure is all you. It's not Paul.
Really? Really?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Then he must believe at some level that men are just ridiculous. Because like all of the male figures in this film are completely ridiculous, non-serious people. On the other hand, I had a real hoot in watching it on that layer of kind of irony. Like there is parts I just laughed out loud. I couldn't believe what they were trying to get away with. It's also this is just a well-shot Skinemax film. Like there is so much full nudity fucking in this film.
Yeah, every other scene. It doesn't feel quite like, oh, we need an excuse for them to fuck in this scene, so let's just make it happen. It doesn't feel quite like that, but it's borderline.
It's paced deliberately. The every 15 minutes, as you get bored, it's like, here comes the skin. Here comes. Yeah. I got to see Michael Douglas contract throat cancer in real time.
I got to see him hang dong for a second or two.
Sure. Got to see it. It's very rare you see male penises in films, especially this era. I got to see a dead dong. I don't know if I've ever seen a dead dong. With gore. I had a great time watching the film for the first time. I don't think as intended, maybe. But what did you think of Basic Instinct?
I think this movie is trying to be way more clever than it actually ends up being. Am I wrong in thinking that, like, we're supposed to understand that she's been planning this murder for 5 years or planning this relationship with him for 5 years. And she did it because he's a shooter. He's a guy who will murder
So when did he get? I thought he killed his first person like 3 years ago. Was it 5 years? Because, yeah, it does seem like that's one of the possible interpretations of this.
Or she's been building like this weird, I don't know, psychopath identity for 5 years, and maybe she's been following him for a year after learning about his shooting proclivities. But like, in my opinion, she is like grooming him to become her next murder buddy. I don't know, because like Roxy feels like a murder buddy, and this old woman who murdered her family feels like
a
murder buddy.
That's what I'm saying. Because like I said, is she? Because like I don't want to get into spoilers because I don't want to turn people off who are like us, and you know, this movie is a little too old for them, and they haven't seen it, and they want to have a hoot with it. I will say it's like pretty offensive even in the time, and it's like stereotypical depiction of like lesbians and bisexuals as you know, evil, depraved murder monsters. So but like there's a couple like 2 years ago I saw Camp Sleepaway, which has a wildly insensitive portrayal of transgender people. Like it's so bad, it's like if a trans director made that exact movie today in the exact same style, people would hail it as high camp. So it's like if you can like put that mindset on, it's like this is so bad, it's actually hilarious in context of 2021. It's kind of like that. Yeah. But I do. Yeah, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of murder. There's non-consensual sex. There's a lot of stuff going on here. Michael Douglas is a fully insane person. And that's, I think, what Verhoeven was trying to get at. The fact that these people are like the same.
Right.
You know, in their attraction to like death and adrenaline and seeking they put Paul Verhoeven is not a very subtle man. He puts Hellraiser in the background, a movie all about demons.
I was wondering.
A movie all about demons who have been so obsessed with sex and pleasure and decadence that they get warped into a helldom. It's fucking Warhammer. These are demons of Slaanesh that just haven't ascended to demonhood yet. And like I said, I think it's interesting and funny, honestly hilarious at parts from that perspective. But
it's also like kind of sloppy in telling you that story. I don't feel like it really definitively states that ever. It's more like you're left to sort of piece that together via a few plot points that are delivered in really sort of mishmash, haphazard kind of way.
I think that's a Verhoeven's deal. Like, is Starship Troopers a takedown of fascism, or is it like a lauding it as the ideal? It's kind of what baggage you take into the film is you know, yeah. RoboCop, condemnation of fetishistic violence and community rotten despair, or is it kind of like a super right wing? We just need super cops to give us ruthless justice and clean up the cities. Like, you know, I feel like Basic Instinct's the same way. It's like if you take a lot of, you know, phobias and hatred towards certain classes of people and the different sexes, then, you know, this is going to be like, I don't know. But if you don't, it's that's what I'm saying. But is it sloppy? Because I felt another thing, like halfway through this movie, I felt like this feels like I'm getting jerked around in exact the same way I felt when I was watching The Usual Suspects. And just like The Usual Suspects, when I got to the ending, I kind of laughed out loud, like, seriously? And I got to this part, like, Roger Ebert wrote a 2-star review of this film. Might be the most savage 2-star review I've ever seen him write. He summed up the film thus. This film is like a crossword puzzle. It keeps your interest until you solve it. Then it's just worthless scrap with the squares filled in. And like, yeah, this is a film that, like, unless you're going to watch your favorite scene to kind of like, you know, help you along, I don't know why you would ever go back and watch this to be like, oh, what's the truth? Because it's almost like the film at the end literally flips a coin and it's like, ah, landed up on heads. Yeah. And then, but what if it was tails? It's such a weird device. I don't think I can say more without heavy spoilers.
And that's part of what I mean by it feels sloppy. I know that the writer of this wrote it in 13 days and they called in another fairly popular writer to kind of not fix the problems of it, but like do some rewrites on it. And they eventually
ended up connective tissue. Yeah.
Yeah. Because the original guy quit because they wanted to change some of his sexier scenes to be less sexy or something. I don't know. And so he quit. They brought in a dude who tried to rewrite it 4 times. They eventually said, you know what? Those scenes actually work. Let's keep them in. Our scenes are stupid. And they reverted back to like the original script. But this whole thing was written in 13 days. It feels like it was written in 13 days. Yeah. Like somebody had a series of clever ideas for twists and ways to like keep the suspense going. And then didn't like write a very tight ending to this thing.
Yeah. Somebody had the weirdest Angela Lansbury boner and wanted to just write some hot Murder She Wrote / fiction. Yeah, that might be a good call. Also, I thought it was interesting that this movie had a battle to get a R rating. They had to take, I think, 17 seconds out of the movie to secure the R rating. But yet they still rape Gene Triplehorn. And that was like, you could another 2 seconds and you could remove the non-consensual part of that scene. It's a weird movie and it's a weird time because I remember that was like constantly like I think it was this and The Crying Game and some others that were just like constant these movies like, oh, they're going to get an X rating. They're going to have to be released into porno theaters. That'll be bad.
I mean, Showgirls was like that, too, right?
Show. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Verhoeven strikes again. Mm-hmm. Werhoven might be Werhoven. I've never actually heard it pronounced.
It could be. It's interesting to me that Michael Douglas picked this movie to do because he had kind of a run of these sort of mystery thriller kind of movies. Mm-hmm. Like when I was watching this, I very much felt like I'm watching The Game, except with naked Sharon Stone in it. Because The Game is like the world is pulling one over on him, or this company that his brother signed him up for to, you know, restart his life because he's like this recluse guy. Mm-hmm. Is basically pulling the same shit, like fucking with his mind, making him question what's real or not. I guess Michael Douglas must like these sorts of films.
Well, does he, or do you just get typecast in a certain way? It's like you do one, maybe. You do one like where you got a femme fatale and you're the predator and she's the predator, or vice versa. And then it's like, oh, well, that worked and people really liked it. I do think it's wild that like Michael Douglas was such a sex symbol. Like, it would be like if Al Pacino became a big, or Gary Oldman became a sex symbol. Like, I've yeah. seen them in sexy things for sure. Mm-hmm. But like, he was a no, like my mom had the fucking vapors for this guy in this era.
Trying to think if I've seen Gary Oldman in something sexy. Dracula. Yeah.
Dracula. Literally the only thing. I think Sid Nancy is a little sexy in that.
I haven't seen that.
But Dracula is the one I can think of where like I've definitely heard a lot of women say, oh, yeah, Gary Oldman did it for me when I was a teenager. But not in real life, just in the film.
It's like Nick Nolte becoming a sex symbol. I don't know.
This movie.
I just can't see it.
Why couldn't I be a sex symbol, Jim? I think this movie looks incredible. It was shot by Jan de Bont, or it might be Jan de Bont, who did the cinematography for Die Hard, also jumped into the director's chair for Speed, Twister, The Haunting. He's got kind of like this very slick, kinetic stylish. You I think we talked about it before this, we recorded a podcast, like this has a distinctly 90s look.
For sure. I just film stock and stuff like that.
Is it the film, or is it just the, like, because you said the same thing about the professional Leon, and is it the film stock, or is it just like the clothes? Because this movie is aggressively 90s in its dress and style.
Yeah, like high fashion when you get to the Sharon Stone stuff, like very like high fashion 90s stuff there.
Yeah. Cutting edge Beverly Hills kind of stuff. But I thought the film looks great. It is consistently visually interesting. The sex scenes are, you know, like I said, it's about the most well lit and shot smut I've ever seen. Did we talk about the full cast? You got Michael Douglas, you got Sharon Stone, who had taken this role after 14 other actors said, no, thank you. We can talk a little bit about this, too. There's some controversy about the stuff that went on the set with her. Stars Gene Triplehorn. And Wayne Knight, Newman, and Stephen Tobolowsky.
Yeah.
Has some brief cameo performances, too. Very young, early work from these gentlemen.
It's got a lot of cameos of people that I recognize from the 90s. Like the shit weasel vice president from Independence Day is in there for a minute or two. Skinner from X-Files is in there for a second or two.
Is he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Huh. Okay.
And then the dude who people recognize as Kruger from Seinfeld plays Nielsen, the internal affairs guy. Those were the people I picked out.
Yeah, there's a lot of those guys in this film. Mm-hmm. What else do we want to talk about? Oh, I will say that, like, I'll go ahead if you have a thought.
I was going to say, I think this movie looks better than it sounds. And it's interesting because people probably recognize the name Jerry Goldsmith. He's done many things, including the Star Trek Next Generation theme, like a lot of iconic music. I think the soundtrack in this, the score, is too much. It's just like, let off the gas for a second, Mr. Goldsmith. Like, I get you're doing something different than what you usually do. You got this neo-noir thriller thing that... Yeah, you're leaning into, but
slash porno soundtrack. Yeah,
right. And you're excited about that. And he, after the fact, said this was his best work to date. And I'm like,
what?
I don't know about your best work. It's certainly your most work. You put in the most time on this thing, but
he watched it over and over again.
I don't like it. I think it's too much. There's no pacing. There's no audio pacing in this thing.
especially since, man, this film is just like, there's so many jerky around near death scenes, and he is right there with the orchestra at max, you know.
Yeah.
Like, if this was a horror movie, every time a cat jumped out, it would be preceded by, like, every string in the house, and the saxophones, and, you know, and then it would just nothing. It's wild.
Yeah.
It's wild. He goes for it.
And it doesn't matter what's happening. Michael Douglas could be laying on the couch watching television, and it's got the mysterious neo-noir strings going, yeah.
Yeah, so I said that we thought this is a prestige film. I don't know, it's a pulp film. It doesn't have warlocks and wizards and dragons in it, but it's not like I would have thought surely, like, from its reputation that, like, someone got nominated for an Oscar, there was some kind of, like, you know, screenplay or supporting role, nothing. No. Because no this awards. Movie is essentially a sexy RoboCop, or
it's Red
or
Shoe
sexy
Diaries.
Starship Troopers.
It's a long episode of Red Shoe Diaries.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And it's funny because as a kid, you know, obviously this was anathema to a witness household. This is everything that's wrong.
Yeah.
You know, just rampant drug use, gays. There's like all, like, you know, premarital, postmarital sex, drinking. Smoking, it's got everything.
They have an objection.
Masturbation,
postmarital sex is not allowed.
It's no, it's intramarriage sex is the only thing. Post and pre, not right out. That's not the loophole. You can marry a woman, divorce her, have as much sex as you want. That's not how that works.
But you're always buried in the eyes of the Lord, right? No.
Yeah, masturbation. You know, Douglas has shown off his calluses. Mm-hmm. It's just all nothing good. But I remember this movie was parodied a lot.
Yeah.
In fact, like, I think it's Hot Shots Part Deux does a lot of, like, shot for shot remakes of some of these sex scenes with the scarf and, like, you know, she's riding him and you think she's going to kill, what is it, Emilio Estevez?
And no, it's Charlie Sheen. Like a chicken? Is
a
that
a screwdriver? No, it's a screwdriver because the headboard was squeaking and she, like, tightens it up and is like, is that better?
Oh, my God.
And she does,
but they,
like,
do
you
that
know,
within this movie, too. It's not,
I
like
know.
That's, it's a parody of itself.
Three times they fake out an ice pick death. Holy shit. So, yeah, but what I'm saying is, like, when, and this, that scene, mm-hmm. is like the first thing that happens in the movie.
Yeah.
So I'm just like, well, this movie is a joke. So this movie is more serious than I gave it credit for, then I stand corrected. But I went in kind of thinking like, oh, yeah, this movie is a bit of a farce.
Oh, let me ask you this. Did you, when that scene was happening and she's banging this Joby, whatever the fuck his name is, Joffrey, I think.
John Bon Jovi. Yeah.
Yeah. When she's banging John Bon Jovi, and she kills him with the ice pick. Did you get the shot where she stabs it through his face?
Yes.
Okay, because I think that's a director's cut from what I read. Like, that's not in the theatrical cut. Because it was one of the scenes they had to pull to not get the NC-17 rating. But I could be wrong.
It was pretty
about
intense
that.
Scene because I couldn't, I didn't care enough to rewind and pause. But, like, I would have believed that that was a real guy's face that they composited. Her just like knife picking a dump because it looked very realistic.
It does, yeah.
As it was happening.
And it's a real quick shot. So.
Well, it's funny because I looked because I wasn't sure and I saw the director's cut was 129 minutes and the actual release is 129 minutes. So apparently the director's cut's literally the 13 seconds they put back in.
Yeah, it's 45 seconds longer from what I read.
Is it 45 seconds? I thought it was okay. So maybe they threw in a couple extra shots of Michael Douglas's bean bag hanging down between his legs. There's a lot
that's what it is. Just close ups.
A lot
from behind.
A lot of bean bag in the movie, too. So did I give a, like, for people that want to kind of know the gist of the movie, should I give a recap, I guess?
You know what this is, but yes. If you're 20, you might not know what this movie is.
There's a violent murder the police have discovered where someone has tied a rich gentleman to a headboard and ice picked him to death in a way exactly described by a leading murder mystery writer, Catherine, played by Rebecca Stone.
Sharon.
Sharon Stone. Thank you, Becky. Sharon Stone and... Michael Douglas is the lead investigator who has had, it turns out, a long history of shooting people, perhaps under the influence of alcohol and drugs. Mm-hmm. and she is the prime suspect because she was also dating this guy, or as she explains it, fucking. And it turns out that she's also bisexual, which is woo. And she's very highly educated, went to Berkeley. She's a psychologist, so she plays with people's minds. And, you know, is Michael Douglas investigating her? Or is she investigating him? She's, and it's basically the whole movie is, did she kill this guy? And then every 5 minutes, they'll be like, definitively, she killed him. And then 5 minutes later, but did she? Tee-hee? And yeah. that's the way the 129 minutes go. With about every 15 minutes, you'll get a lavish, several minute long sex scene of Michael Douglas sucking tit and mouth and muff and thrusting and looking fierce.
Sex in this is a little weird at times, like. Some of it's hot, some of it's good, but like there's this weird motion that Sharon Stone does when she's reaching for the ice pick behind her. She's like thrusting in this weird, like herky jerky way that couldn't get anyone off, let alone Sharon Stone and Michael Douglas.
Your penis is at negative 56 degrees. Blast off would be quite impossible at that angle.
It's just the way she's moving is weird. But granted, she's reaching for an ice pick for murder. I don't think she's concerned about the way she's moving.
Right. One out of, and then did she ever reach for an ice pick at any point in this movie to kill anyone? I don't know.
Oh, that's a good point. Like she's doing that herky jerky bullshit. And the non-sexual motion, Michael Douglas is thinking, I'm having the fuck of the century. So what do I know?
Right.
Maybe
it's true.
Maybe she knows what she's doing.
That's the movie. And it keeps you guessing until the very, very last scene.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for podcasts that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
So I guess let's talk about this film. There's a lot of stuff that, like, Michael Douglas, they talk about him being a damn fine cop. And a lot of movies, I've seen a lot of movies, a lot of television shows where you see a damn fine cop that's consumed with their demons. You know, they're doing blow on the side, or they're doing too much alcohol. They're having reckless sex that's harming their marriage and their career and all this stuff. I don't know why Michael Douglas is considered a good cop. I don't think he makes a single, like, well-founded, well-researched, meticulous observation in this whole film. In fact, the first scene of him is kind of bumbling around the crime scene. Like, this is some Ace Ventura shit. He accidentally bumps the stereo and it turns on real loud music as the coroner's trying to give the gory details, and everybody looks at him. He's like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm a fuck up. Everyone calls him Shooter, but it's derisively because he's had like 5 bad shoots in the last 5 years. It's almost a parody because, like, there's this subplot of him being investigated by the Internal Affairs Department, and there's a police psychologist assigned to his case, and you find out that he's been fucking her. I don't understand.
Alone.
The conflict of interest. Yeah. And then later in the movie, like, she says, oh, I've been off the sauce and smoking. And like literally 10 minutes later, she walks into a bar, a cop bar, and he's pounding Jack Daniels and smoking. But then later that night they have sex. But like, he also, it's non-consensual sex that why is he a good cop?
I couldn't really tell you. Maybe it's because he just won't let it go. Right. He's one of those cops that like gets a hunch and he runs that hunch into the ground. He runs it all the way down. And the other cops weren't willing to do that. Right. They brought her in. She passed the lie detector. OK, she's free to go. But he knows better.
Yeah.
That intuition. Yeah.
It's why, because also, like, it seems like everyone on the force hates him, too. Like, even
everybody except
the one
partner,
guy who's
even
his partner. And by the last half of the movie, once he finds out that he's literally fucking the chief murder suspect, he's just like, this guy like has long tirades about what a dumb fuck this guy is. He can't
which
believe
he's
it.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like some of the stuff. It's like, so like I feel like Michael Douglas potentially could be the co-villain of this film. And I also wonder if it's like, because I was trying to count the potential murder victims that she has. If you count her parents, okay, so she, like, heavy spoilers here. If she killed her parents, if she killed her boyfriend, and she killed her college professor, and then she murdered the roommate, I think they imply that, she has 5 deaths, and I think Michael Douglas has 5 shoots, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like there is this intentional parallel. And it's the same kind of justification. Well, I'm just doing it for my job. It's just research. And Michael Douglas is like, well,
I think they're doing something here that's like, I don't know, because I can't tell if this movie is about whether or not Sharon Stone is a murderer. Because like the whole movie, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, she's clearly a murderer. But I don't know if that's because of my knowledge of the movie from, you know, pop culture osmosis over the last 25 years or whatever, or if that's because the movie is leading me down that path. But I also get the feeling like the movie is just trying to depict a man who is a certain type of guy who is able to be seduced by a certain type of woman. And that is like the point of the movie. It's not necessarily about the murders. It's about the seduction itself. But all of it is so like nebulous. It doesn't ever quite put its stamp on it.
Yeah. It is funny because like this woman leads these men, like Sharon Stone leads all the men in this movie around by their noses. Like even the ones that are like 100% sure they're like, there's a great scene where Michael Douglas, I think, is 100% convinced he's going to die. And there's abundant opportunity to stop the thing from happening. It's like Joker's putting Batman into the sawmill to split him in half. And Batman's just kind of looking there with fear and lust in his eyes. Again, Godzilla versus King Kong. God damn it. Shot for shot remake of the scene I'm talking about. She's scratching his back, drawing blood. He's like, oh, my God. She rolls on top of him. She's looking in his eyes. She's like, are you going to stop me? This is exactly how the movie started. Uh-huh. You're getting tied up. And I got something here in my sheets and I'm going to like, but it's, I don't, it's,
I couldn't tell you why she doesn't kill him. in this
movie.
Well,
the thing is like I can kind of understand getting led around by a man or woman if you have a relationship with them and you're invested into it. I don't know. Maybe I've never had the fuck of the century, but it just seems insane to me that like a person can make you come so good that you're going to throw all this shit out the window to chase it. I think that's like implies that he's just kind of an insecure chump, right? Like,
yeah, or, and that's what I mean. Like,
have you ever heard of the phrase bitch made? Like, I feel like that's, you could throw this at Michael Douglas in this movie. It's not a good simp. He's simping for the serial killer pussy.
Sure.
It's not a good look.
We're now kicked off Twitch. Thanks for that. But
I did not use it as an insult. It was just a term to describe the character. Yeah,
talked about Michael Douglas.
It's not a pattern coordinated harassment.
Okay. Well, we are going pretty hard on this movie and Michael Douglas in this movie.
That's true.
Yeah, man. I don't know. I think it's about like he's seduced by whatever this woman has, and the charms of Sharon Stone are pretty much lost on me. Like, I get it. She's a gorgeous woman. I'm not going to deny that, but she's just not my type. She's like the glamorous type, right? The model type. I mean, she was a model before this, right?
I don't know. Cause she was 35. And I know, I think she'd done a few things
she's
before.
She's 35
but this is the
in
thing,
this? Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I did. This is the thing that put her on the map.
Yeah.
As far as I can tell, from
and then she did, yeah, a few other things. Casino, we talked about that. I think I said, amazing. Yeah, she's like, I recognize that she's gorgeous. I'm just not that into her. Hmm. But Michael Douglas, that the character Nick is very much into her, and I think like he doesn't. I don't know. They play it like all the men in this movie are into her, like you said. Like if you look at the interrogation scene, right, the
oh
leg crossing
God.
Scene,
high comedy.
Yeah, I mean Wayne Knight is basically salivating. He's dripping from the mouth as she crosses and
you've
cross
seen
her legs.
Jim Carrey in The Mask when he sees Cameron Diaz for the first time. Uh-huh. He turns into a cartoon wolf and his tongue rolls
up. Tongue, yeah,
yeah, sure. like he's Wayne Knight is swallowing his tongue. His eyes are popping out of his head. It's crazy. Yeah,
yeah.
And so, Michael Douglas is not any better. Like every man in his interrogation is just like visibly sweating. Breathing heavy. The camera work is lurid.
Uh-huh.
Like they're just swinging and pushing into people's faces and stuff. It's wild.
So let's talk real quick about that scene, because that's the scene, right? That's the scene that everybody, if you know anything about Basic Instinct, you know that Sharon Stone uncrosses her legs and you get to see Sharon's stone. Yeah. Apparently, according to Sharon Stone, she was not aware that you were actually going to be able to see anything, and that she was told this will be hidden in shadow and not to worry about it. She only found out that you could see everything in a screening of this movie after it was edited and everything, which is fucking horrifying, I would think.
Oh, I can't even imagine. Like, because there's a lot, you know, that's the thing. Like, we've talked about this before, how directors sometimes just fuck with the stars to get better performances or whatever. But this seems very predatory.
Yeah.
The way Sharon tells it, and there's been no rebuttal refutation of it. Mm-hmm. She was wearing like white panties on the set to match her dress. And they wanted the scene. She knew that scene was going to be in it, but it was going to be the implication. And Verhoeven said, there's a problem. The panties are just like super bright on the camera, and we can tell that you're, and it's robbing the scene of effect. So take it off. It's like super dark. No one can see it, but super obvious and visible. And they insisted to like, you know, I guess it was there was like, I don't know, no vag clause in her contract, whatever. And she found out, as you said, the night of the premiere that's what happened. And she's like, she slapped Verhoeven. She stormed out, immediately called her lawyer. But then, like, you know, when you read her like stream of consciousness about it, it's about like, oh, God, what is it going to look like if, because she did fight for this role. Verhoeven fought for her for the studio because she, you know, there was a lot of like she had a lot of mutual respect and stuff. And that he lied to her really was a wound, but also something in the context of like, well, what could this film mean for me? Like, it's the same decision process that many, many actors.
Yeah.
actresses made before her that led to such a, you know, I don't want to make this sound like it's the actress's fault.
No,
but they
no.
made a lot of rational decisions for their career and for their art that led to people getting away with shit like this and worse. It's the biggest scene in the movie, and it was filmed without the actress's consent.
Yeah, that's it was surprising to me because I always thought that this was some kind of weird empowerment scene for women, right? It totally changed my perspective on what I thought this scene was, seeing it and reading about the aftermath of it.
Yeah, it's supposed to be this big power. You're right. A power fantasy of a woman who has complete control of these men, and she's flexing on them intellectually. She's flexing on them like from a status because she's wealthier and more accomplished than all these men. And she's teasing them and all that stuff. And it, you know, the thing is, it's like they did it for and for what? For a half second of vagina, like as a 44-year-old man that's seen a share of vaginas at this point, like.
Well,
the effect would be 100% the same if it was just like visibly uncrossed and that area had been shadowed in, right?
You don't think the scene plays out the same? In the media, not its effect on her career,
not its effect on culture.
Like this movie was only talked about because of that scene, because you could
see. Talking about this in 2021 as a 44. Yeah, sure.
So, right. And in the 90s, this was talked about everywhere. Like you said, it was parodied everywhere. It kind of made Sharon Stone's career. I mean, she was in Total Recall before this, which is probably the highest profile thing she had done, which is another Paul Verhoeven movie. But after this, you know, she went on to do a lot of other big movies. And I think it's because of the fame she got from that scene. And I imagine it's probably, like you said, complicated for her personally. But yeah, it wouldn't have been the same if people weren't talking about it as like, oh, my God, did you see that scene?
Yeah. This movie. It does this kind of infuriating thing where it comes up with the twin hypothesis. It's stated nakedly at the end of the first act. I have Stephen Tobolowsky in there.
Right.
He's the criminal profiler. And he's like, well, because they've got this thing where they said that, hey, apparently this is an author. Her boyfriend was killed in the exact same manner. And, you know, as someone killed in the book, and you got the Michael Douglas immediately goes out and buys the book, and he calls his partner, page 67. She does him with the ice pick, like smoking gun. And they get Tobolowsky in here. He's like, well, there's only two possibilities. There's two possibilities. The person who wrote this book is your murderer, or it's someone who wants to harm the writer. So you're going to deal with some devious, diabolical mind or someone with a deep-seated, irrational hatred. Either way, they have an utter disrespect for human life. And they flip between like those exact hypothesis for the rest of the movie. But I was also struck because I wrote this down because I thought it'd be important is like that Michael Douglas displays all of these abilities, too. You know, that is someone that wants to like because he vacillates between someone who's obsessed with the writer and someone who wants to bring the writer down. He has a devious, diabolical mind. He exploits people. He manipulates people. He lies to gain an advantage. He uses physical force to cow people and threaten even people in his own police, even people in internal affairs. He almost goes down for the murder of a cop because it's so believable that he would have like got coked up and shot this guy in the face. There's this scene where Sharon Stone is like going down. What is that? U.S. Highway number one.
Yeah. Talk about it's a disregard for human life.
Yeah. And I'm like. She's instigating it because she's in the turns out Lotus and he's in the shit box. But like he keeps chasing her. And I'm like, that's like this utter disrespect for human life. And like his nonchalant about like, oh, it was a shooting. People got caught in the crossfire. Like, fuck, man, you're supposed to make sure of your target. What's behind the target? That's like what rule four of gun of the this laws of safe discharge of a firearm. I just felt like. Again, intentionally, this movie is painting Michael Douglas as like the twin villain. They also crucially, Sharon Stone shacks up with many murderers throughout the film. Every person she makes a personal connection to is a multiple murderer. And then Michael Douglas at the end.
Yeah.
And The other thing is, like, I can't believe how many people write these goddamn definitive whodunits. And they mention the ice pick at the end as like the definitive proof that Sharon Stone was the murderer of all these people and was going to murder Michael Douglas. But I'm not sure. Because, like, at that point, I think she's just considered him one of her murderers that she's going to hang out with the rest of her life.
Right. And that's the question that I have is, like, why doesn't she murder him? Because I don't think the movie ever tells me why she doesn't. She doesn't want to.
He's no longer a threat to her.
She doesn't want to just like, what is the line they have where it's like, oh, we're going to make love or we're going to fuck like minxes.
Fuck like minx. Yeah.
And have.
Punch kids out like movie tickets or some shit.
Sure, yeah. And she's like, no movie tickets. And he's like, okay, no movie tickets. Just fuck like mixes. Is that her having a change of heart? Is that her just like, I'll have one more fuck of the century before I murder this guy tomorrow night?
Well, the other thing is, I freeze framed on it and I couldn't see any blood on the ice pick. We know she has an ice pick. She uses it all the time to chop up ice. So it's like,
Yeah.
This, you know, panning, she's like, she awkwardly reaches for, I wrote one guy's like, well, she tried to reach for the ice pick and she couldn't find it, but this is just, it fell on the ground. But this is just implicating that like Michael Douglas is going to be dead sooner or later. This is a fatal attraction kind of thing. And I'm like, I don't think so. I think she might've just got drunk and chipped up ice and just, you know, or like as they're fucking around, they violently fuck around the apartment. It gets flung over. Cause like, what am I supposed to believe? Yeah. She had it right there and that thing clatters to the floor. And Michael Douglas is like, what's going on, minx? You know, she violently comes back with, it's like, I don't know. I feel like this movie is very much a Rorschach test, or the Verhoeven thinks it's a Rorschach test. Yeah, it's like, well, what do you, if you hate women and lesbians and you're going to automatically, if you think that she's just a smart person who's interested in the darker aspects of human nature as a novelist, as a crime writer, and as a psychologist, and she befriends these people who have done these things, but herself not take a part of it. On the other hand, how the hell did Jean Triplehorn know to be at that building and kill this dude in the way that she did?
Right. Because they say, only reason she left me a message, but then the message isn't on her machine. Maybe she deleted it, but the tape was brand new, not even used. So.
And, you know, we saw the ending of the book being literally fresh off the printer. Like it's like that part was being printed on the line printer. Now, I mean, the other thing is like, maybe she emailed her a copy or something. But I, you know, I sense the movie's got this kind of like.
But why would she?
Schrodinger's box.
You don't mail the psychopath who's been trying to pretend to be you for the last 5+ years or whatever a copy of your manuscript to check out so they can recreate a murder.
Right.
That you wrote about in your book and frame you. Like, you don't do that. That's.
But would she steal it? Would she have access to Sharon Stone's house so she could go and steal it? Or would she have a piece of spyware? I mean, I guess it's 93. Nobody was really thinking in those terms back then.
No, and the movie certainly doesn't.
I mean, it's just so, so lined up to like open and shut. Like if it wasn't for that line where Jean Triplehorn said, oh, yeah, my lock's been broken. I have had a hard time. Like it'd be no for sure she killed, because I still don't understand. She shows up there and like Michael Douglas got a gun on her and she knows all the background of like what's been going on with Catherine and her and Michael Douglas. Mm-hmm. And she refuses to show her hands.
Yeah.
And then she like violent, like she pulls a
I mean, this is the ending of Gran Torino on him.
Yeah. Yes. I'm like, you know, it's like I'm usually like, yeah, you know, make the bad shoot and I'm hard on cops. But on the other hand, like if you got a gun in your face and someone's saying slowly take your hands out of your pocket and you're like, I can't fucking believe you're doing this. I can't fucking, as you're slowly advancing with your pocket bulging towards them, then you I mean, Jesus, I might shoot you. And I'm not inclined to do that. It's dark. He couldn't tell if he had a gun. And I don't know. It was absurd. And then. The final way they shot that, like, I can't believe he had the balls to do it. And in fact, like, I'm not sure now that you've raised the specter of this being the director's edition. Did the theatrical release have both of those endings? where she violently rolls over and just cuddles him, and then it goes fades to black. Mm. And then it comes back in. You have a 6-second shot of the same thing from a different direction, and the thing pans to show a ice pick underneath the bed.
I don't know if there's multiple endings to this thing.
Yeah,
I didn't read about any multiple endings. I will say ice picks. I don't get them. I don't get ice picks. Like every time they whip out this ice pick and a block of ice, I'm thinking, but you're just ruining your countertop, A. You got a bunch of stab marks all over your countertop, and B, there's ice going everywhere. You lose half the ice to the floor. This is the worst way to make ice. And it's like, look, you have $110 million or whatever it is. Get a fucking ice maker.
She likes sharp edges, Jim.
Oh, God, you're right.
She says that. I like jagged edges. And I grew up in a house with an ice pick. And I will say, it's like, so we had the ice molders, and then we had the ice bin.
Scullies.
And every once in a while, the ice in the bin would melt together and they'd fuse into blocks, and you had to use that ice pick. Now, we always use it inside the container, you know, so the ice does. But chips of ice would fly because it's kind of a violent process. But yeah, I didn't think, but now I wouldn't just have like giant blocks of ice that I'm, you know, pickaxing because I want sharp edges. But
yeah.
I've never been accused of being Sharon Stone.
Just make cubes. Cubes are better.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
There's just some hilarious scenes in there, this too. Like, you know, I used the S-I-M-P word, but like, I love the scene where Michael Douglas comes in and declares to Sharon Stone that like, that is the fuck of the century. And she just laughs in his face.
Yeah. He's like, what? You don't think so?
She's like, did you not hear me say that this other like rock and roller spent a year and a half getting good at pleasing my pussy? And you think you set the high score on the first night? What the fuck? That is maybe for you. Because I was Godzilla to your King Kong, and you didn't know whether I was going to breathe atomic fire down your throat or not. But
also, I don't know.
All I breathe down is HPV down your throat. What?
I'm not sure if this rocker could have given her the fuck of the century, because apparently he's a rocker with no criminal record. Like, he's in the fucking Eagles or something. What rocker do you know that doesn't have a criminal record? Has at least like smashed up a hotel room or drived a few times.
Oh God. Yeah. Like she's yeah. Uh-huh.
Like she's fucking, yeah, not even Don Henley. Cause at least Don Henley did drugs.
Donny Osborne. She's like, yeah, she's rock and roll. Ex rock and roll. So the guy from the Monkees or some shit. Like,
I don't buy that. He was giving her the fuck of the century either.
This ain't Axl Rose.
No.
I also love where he goes before three different internal affairs boards in this movie. And the last one, like he sits down and like right off the bat, they're like, tell us about your parents growing up. He's like, let's just get to the chase. Number one, I didn't hate my dad even after I figured out what he and mommy were doing in the bathroom. Number two, I haven't wet the bed in a really long time. Number three, I don't look in the toilet before I flush. And number four, go fuck yourself. And he just gets up and storms out. How does this guy have a badge?
I don't know.
Like this is the first question 10 seconds in. Again, multiple internal affairs investigations for wrongful shootings and bad shoots and, you know, fucking a murder victim and raping an internal affairs investigator, psychologist. It's oh, God. It's like laugh out loud funny. And then the reveal of Lisa Hoberman being Jean Triplehorn, I thought was another ridiculous detail. Like it played out like an Ace Ventura reveal, you know.
Triplehorn is Hoberman. Yes.
Hoberman is Triplehorn. It was literally like that, minus the transphobia.
Right.
Plus the biphobia. And the way it was shot and filmed was, oh my God, it is so funny. And also, like, when his partner finally dies.
Oh no.
All I could think is what this guy must be thinking as he's lying there slashed to death by either the psychologist that Michael Douglas has mind fucked into doing this, or the criminal suspect that you have been for the last half of the movie saying you're a dumb fuck, you're going to get burnt for this, you're going to go down for this, and you're the one that holds the butcher's bill at the end, and you're looking up and Michael Douglas is just looking at you like, well, this is another thing that's happening to me in this movie. Like, can you imagine? He's like, blood just blah, blah, blah. And Michael Douglas like, oh, God damn it. Now I guess maybe she's this best pussy I've ever had. Maybe murder pussy. I don't know.
Yeah. Another data point.
Yeah. And the constant death baiting at the end, they pull the Schrodinger's ice pick, I think, three times in the last five final minutes of them, doing the closing fucking of the scene. It's a tour de force performance, I thought.
This movie. You talked about Michael Douglas being a sex symbol, and I kind of knew that he was in the 90s, but also when Sharon Stone is out on the dance floor and she's like basically beckoning him to dance with her, I'm like, there's no fucking way Michael Douglas is going to have even a single move. This man won't dance. It's impossible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I remembered The Breakfast Club and I thought, you know, if he pulled that out right now, she'd probably go
home.
Starts
doing cartwheels and shit.
The punches. The cartwheels. I'm like, okay, he's either not going to dance a single bit, which he doesn't. He doesn't dance at all. Or he's going to do that dance.
His leaned and did the rock away. I thought that scene was hilarious because they walk in and this is literally an unlicensed version of the Mortal Kombat theme that they're playing for the duration of this scene. It just does like something slightly different at the end. And he shows up looking like a dad chaperoning a high school dance. Like, yes. This is a high fashion, like, What is it? Studio 21 type of deal, like where everyone's like dressed to kill and they're all some kind of like goth or high model or glam. And he's wearing this like almost the next generation Wesley Crusher get up.
Uh-huh.
You know, yeah, like this is like fancy. What? Yeah, this is 50s. And the thing Michael Douglas is in is mid to late 50s in this movie.
Gee, everybody's 20 years older than I think they are in this movie. Christ.
Yeah. There is that. But like, I just thought that's like, again, does this movie know that this guy is deeply uncool? And I the only reason that, like, obviously the only reason that Sharon Stone's attracted to him is because he's the shooter.
Right.
I did buy, like, I don't know, because that's the other pretty damning piece of evidence. Like, what? Why would Gene Triplehorn arrange to sell all of this guy's information to the Eternal Affairs guy to give it to Sharon Stone months before they even started having the affair? Like, that's, but that, yeah, that works if it's Sharon Stone just doing research on the guy. She gets fascinated by, like, I want to write that next book because it's the guy shooting people. It doesn't require Michael Douglas getting directly involved with her. But
yeah, I don't know why she would give up that information. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff that I have questions about. Let's talk real quick about Roxy, who tries to at some point murder Michael Douglas, right? She gets so jealous of this bisexual woman's relationship with a man that she tries to run him down in the Lotus. The
lesbian rage is well documented, just as deadly.
Exotic sports car, right? And she's they come out of this, I can't remember if this is a scene right after they come out of this country western bar or whatever, and they go to a diner, and he's, you know, his buddy is like talking, oh, pussy something in the diner. Everybody's looking at him. Kind of funny scene. I don't know, I chuckled. But then Michael Douglas walks out of this place.
Magnum cum laude pussy is what he was shouting.
Right.
Magnum cum laude pussy.
He walks out of this place. It's pitch black outside. There's not a sound in the street. There's no hustle and bustle out there. It's quiet. And this Roxy character prowls up behind him, sneaks up behind him, as silent as can be, in a fucking exotic sports car. A car that's probably got 12 cylinders and about 150 decibels.
Snarling like 12 Panthers back there.
And he's walking like he doesn't hear a damn thing until she revs, intentionally revs the engine behind him. I'm like, you cannot sneak up on somebody in a Lamborghini equivalent. You can't do it.
Maybe she had that Knight Industries 2000 Knight Rider stealth mode operator that the kit could always switch into. You know,
just be
really super baffle those.
And
pipes.
Then he chases her down in a fucking Ford.
He does
Ford
so much work in that brown Econobox, man.
Yeah.
Like, holy hell.
Yeah.
He's
the
got
stairs.
Like a late 80s Chevy Malibu. He's chasing this, like chasing exotic sports cars down twisty highways. And driving up and downstairs.
I read that Michael Douglas drove up these stairs three times in preparation for this. Like, he'd just go out at night.
He actually did the
and
stunt?
Drive up these stairs. That's what I read.
Are you fucking with me?
No, I'm serious.
Okay.
I think it's in the Wikipedia article. He drove up these stairs.
One thing I thought was smart about this movie, oh God, I can't believe I'm going to say it. One thing that was mildly clever about this movie is when we first introduced Roxy, I actually thought it was Sharon Stone because it was shot dark and they had very similar kind of like slick back hair and like facial structure and all that kind of stuff. And then I'm like, oh wow, Sharon Stone's got a really different look in this movie. She's like, you know, a little bit, I don't know, Sopranos side girl.
Yeah.
But then they show it's actually, and I'm like, huh, that's interesting. And they did the same thing with Gene Triplehorn when they showed her old like Berkeley photo. She had like long blonde hair like Sharon Stone. I'm like, okay, this is kind of interesting that they're doing this intentional, like, well, if you saw this in a darkened hallway, would you know it was Catherine, or would you know it was Roxy, or would you know it was Beth? And they're kind of was able to switch the focus on, because at first you thought it was Roxy, you know, and then I don't know. I say it's clever, but it's just like I think Roger Ebert got it wrong, because at the last slot of the crossword puzzle was like a three letter word that starts with B and ends with T. And you're not sure if it's bat or bot, and you'll never be sure because the last clue is so fucking, I don't know how you could get between bat and bot. I don't know. Robot with echolocation or something. I'm not sure how you could, but like, that's what it felt like to me.
And the clue is just small teeth.
It's kind of how I felt about at the end of, what was that? What was the last, Christopher Nolan movie, Tenet, mm-hmm. where it's like, you know, another watch and I could probably have this down cold, but I got no desire to give this thing another watch.
Yeah, I'm not going to watch this again. Yeah. You can see Sheridan Stone's character from this movie in another movie. Did you know that she's the character, Catherine Tramell, is in Last Action Hero? Briefly.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that sounds correct. I really like Last Action Hero. I wish we should do it sometime.
We will, yeah, sometime.
I don't know if it's good. I really liked it as a teenager, as a big fan of Arnold Schwarzenegger and as a big fan of like 80s action movies. It was like a really fun takedown of that kind of stuff. But,
yeah.
She's also straight up in, there's a sequel to Basic Instinct, Basic Instinct 2, which I kind of want to watch now.
Yeah, it was made 14 years later. Which I guess put Sharon Stone in her late 70s. I don't know because
she's only in her late 50s.
I thought
50s,
she was in her late
I looked that up when we saw her in the New Pope this year. She was like in her late 50s. So she's still. Huh. So I guess she'd have been in her late 40s, right?
Oh, probably. I
don't know. Yeah. Basic Instinct 2. When was that thing made?
2006,
right?
Yeah.
But who did it? Like who? It's directed by Michael Caton Jones. Like, so nobody that was involved in the original. I was like, if it's Paul Verhoeven, it's a must see. But yeah.
Strikes me as like a cash in sequel on whatever residual fame was left.
David Morrissey, the governor.
Oh,
is
really?
Michael Douglas in this thing, I guess.
Oh boy.
And the
okay.
The poster is her with her legs about to be uncrossed, sitting in a chair. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
You got anything more you want to say about this movie, Basic Instinct?
Nope, I'm good. I don't think this is a great movie. I don't think it's a terrible movie. I think it's a messy movie that
It's a lot like a lot of Verhoeven's work. It's inappropriate, it transgresses boundaries, it's highly satirical, and it's a lot of fun to watch under the influence of various things. But just watching it straight up as a prestige film, I was expecting kind of like some really interesting twists and turns, and then I'm like, oh fuck, it's a Paul Verhoeven. I got schnookered by all the overemphasis on the snatch stuff. Cause you're right. Mm-hmm. This film, the only reason it loomed large in my mind is because of all the controversy. And this film is just not even that controversial. It's just dumb and cliched, but very well shot. So yeah. So next time for Prestige, we're going to come back with the film Amadeus, which I've seen in the last 6 months and thought held up really well. It's really interesting story. I don't think the historicity, it's more of a historiography. But it's about Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart and his intense rivalry with this other composer in the French court. I think his name is Scolari. And it's played by what's that guy? F. Lee Murphy Abraham.
F. Murray Abraham.
F. Lee Murray Abraham II plays Scolari. And it's just a great performance. I don't want to say too much of the spoiler, but it's a really absorbing, watchable film. And I can't wait to talk about it next week. That's what we're going to. That is a prestige film that actually got a lot of critical buzz. It won some awards and such.
That scene where Abraham uncrosses his legs. Holy shit. It's going to blow your mind.
Reveals the full Murray. Yeah.
The full Murray.
Yeah. Then the Lee too. We'll be back next week to talk about that. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.